and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at director Akira Kurosawa and his 1947 film, One Wonderful Sunday. Returning on the show today to talk about One Wonderful Sunday is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So this, when you recommended this movie, and it's a Kurosawa film, I'm a big Kurosawa fan. I was introduced to him probably like a lot of kids through film school when we watched Seven Samurai. And since then, I've, you know, tried to devour everything he's done almost. And like when you said this is a Kurosawa film, I was like, huh, I've never even heard of this movie. There's films of his I haven't seen, but at least like, oh yeah, I'm aware of it. And this movie I've never even heard of. And overall, like I said, we'll definitely get into the flaws I have with this movie, but I'd say it's a pretty good film. It's, like I said, it's... To me, it's a little bit of he still hasn't quite hit that Kurosawa peak that we best know him for, but I still think it's solid.
Yeah, it doesn't have the sweeping epic of his bigger films. But yeah, it's a solid effort. And it actually came in a box set that was called, you know, post-war Kurosawa. And
Criterion.
All of the movies in the set are kind of Ozu-esque. You know, instead of being, you know, like about samurais or tough guys, it's, you know, human family stories and, you know, shot in that way that feels very intimate, like you're in the room with the people.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing because I was thinking of this because if I watched this film and I didn't watch the credits or know who this was, I'd almost would guess that like, this seems a little bit kind of an Ozu film. Now, there's a little bit different because Ozu's famous for, like, having, you know, these establishing shots of, you know, they kind of go around and around and around until they finally get to the scene, you know, and the tatami mats, and then kind of the shots where they like, it almost looks like the actors are looking right at the camera. So it doesn't have that stuff, but I can see, like you said, the story-wise, it's focused a lot more on family drama and, you know, people issues more than, like, the epic stuff that Kurosawa is best known for.
It's also a romance, which sort of makes it seem not quite Kurosawa's wheelhouse. But I think he does a good job with it. It also reminds me a little bit of It's a Wonderful Life in a way, the sort of sad sack, you know, character who is beaten down by life, who is very cynical, but, you know, you really realize he's got a heart of gold.
Yeah, the cynic with a heart of gold.
And then, you know, the cheerful, sweet.
Always just thinking on the bright side no matter what.
Yes. Yeah.
And what's another interesting why this doesn't really seem like a Kurosawa film is it doesn't, he always has that usual core of actors, you know, Toshirô Mifune,
Setsuro,
Takashi Shimura has been in everything. So like, even when he's like not the main character, he'll show up even like a little small gig, you know, and like, and there's others. I know one of the guys that was in the Seven Samurai that was like the lone badass one. He's shown up in a few things. There's more I could go on and on and on, but there's none. The two main actors, like I even looked them up on IMDb to see if they were anything else I've seen. Nothing.
Nothing.
And it's what's interesting. It features none of his usual core of actors. It's like, you know, like John Ford has his crew, Kurosawa has his crew, and it's interesting. Like once again, this is before he kind of had those collaborations started out. But this is nobody I really know.
Yeah, and I don't know. Maybe that's genius of the choice because it would have just seemed so much more like, you know, somebody else's movie. Making them sort of generic means it's more of an everyman story.
Yeah. Well, I think also, like, once again, this was 1947. Kurosawa had only been making movies for like 4 or 5 years, so he was still kind of young in his directing career. So maybe this was before the time he could afford to get the big names, because people like, you know, at this time, Kurosawa, who's that?
Although in that box set, you know, some of the people that he usually worked with show up in some of his movies. So it was the right period. I don't know if it was a conscious choice for this movie or if this was who he was able to get.
Just curious. I mean, you're talking about the box. I know it's Criterion. Is it called like the Eclipse series?
Yes. Yeah, it's the seventh one of those.
Yeah. I never, like, I don't know why they call it the Eclipse series. It's when I was watching some Ozu films. There's like a lot of his stuff is in this Eclipse series. I wonder if that means it's like the lesser known director's work or.
Oh, that's a great question because I always thought that it was just the name of the. Of the group because
it's okay, probably
because I think there's an Eclipse set that has like the Seven Samurai and stuff in it. I'll have to look at that.
Yeah, because Seven Samurai, that's Criterion. Like, I imagine when Criterion like first started, like, we got to get Seven Samurai. That's one of the first ones they ever had. But like that, you know, you don't see this on Criterion, their main thing. It's Eclipse. I wonder if like that's like an off-brand Criterion, or I don't know.
I'll have to look into that because that's a very good question. Everything, of course, had you know, wonderful subtitles, and the discs were good quality, but there was no commentary or anything else. Which is always kind of, you know, you always want that stuff.
You always have the little booklet thing that has like somebody's commentary, like why this film is so essential in film history. And so when I was talking about when we were going over the script earlier today, you said, "What's a deep cut?" And I would say this is a good example of a deep cut. So a lot of people are probably wondering what I mean by deep cuts. I think people have different words for it. Like in music, some people say, "Oh, that's a deep track," but a deep cut for me is like somebody's work, but it's, while good, it's sort of been buried under like their better known stuff. Like I'll talk about other deep cuts from other directors, but when I like a deep cut from like a David Lynch, I would say is The Straight Story, which is a really good movie.
And that is a really good movie.
Like there's probably others I'm thinking, like that's the one that comes to mind the most. Like a deep cut I would say from like Sam Peckinpah would be like, you know, Junior Bonner or Cross of Iron. I could go on and on, but like that's sort of like good movies, but like, you know, because they've done other great work, this stuff gets buried under.
Yep. Okay. I understand. Deep cut.
All right. Yeah.
Thanks for the new term.
And what's other interesting, this film, it feels that this is a lot about post-World War II Japan. Because you see the bombed out remains of the city. I'm assuming, is it Tokyo?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Tokyo.
Yuzo is a soldier, and you know, he seems like he hasn't been the same since the war. You see a lot in like when you, even when you see like they're playing the baseball game, one of the trucks drives by as a military truck. So you can still see this is 1947. So the war is just 2 years old, if that. So you can definitely see in this movie, like it almost seems like it's a movie about what Japanese citizens have had to deal with since the war ended.
But what's interesting is it could be set anywhere. It could be Italy. Mm. It could be the United States. Any place post-war where young people are trying to put their lives together and nobody has any money. Although some people have money. You know, they do people like
club
at the cabaret. Yeah. You wonder, how did those people, you know, maintain their lifestyle throughout the war? Their fur coats and their top hats and their fancy stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you talked about how it could be almost in Italy, that's sort of one of the things that almost feels like a Italian neo-realist film. Mm-hmm. You think of The Bicycle Thief, which is the most obvious one, where they're driving all around through the streets of Italy and everything's been bombed out, remnants of World War II. And like
could
in this,
be Rome Open City, too.
Rome Open City, yeah. So once again, you see in this, when they're walking through the remains, everything's bombed out. They still have military trucks driving by. So the war is still fresh in everybody's mind.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that post-war poverty and that idea of scouring the city, helplessly looking for something that is going
good
to...
good point.
Yeah. So it has sort of the same depressing outlook and a little bit of the same story in a way.
And even think of Bicycle Thieves when they get a little money and then he's all excited. He takes his kid to the restaurant. It's like, we're going to eat like, you know, Kings tonight. And like even think of this movie when they kind of get back together, they go like, you know, let's not worry about the troubles. And they go to a diner and have some coffee and have some pastries. So like, you know, it kind of reminds me of that scene in Bicycle Thieves.
Yeah. And we can do whatever we want because we're men. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great line from Bicycle Thieves. Yeah. But while they're in that restaurant, they can't order anything they want. All they can order is cheese and bread. Everybody else can order pizza and, you know, bigger and better meals.
But it
doesn't
matter to
matter
them.
Because,
cheese and bread,
cheese
that's
and
a,
bread and we're men.
Know, that's great anyway.
It is, yes.
And it's interesting because this is 1947. And historical-wise, we were still occupying Japan at that time. And this was still made when Japanese films were kind of under American censorship. Think of Ozu's Early Spring. In one of the most famous scenes in that movie is they're driving by and there's a Coca-Cola sign. Mm-hmm. So even this film, you can kind of see a bit of, I don't think, some people say, is he making a commentary on American occupation? I don't think he is. He's just noticing that it's there. Like the one thing, you see the kids playing baseball. Give a little bit of historical background. back in the early 30s, a lot of famous Major League Baseball players like Babe Ruth went in and visited Japan, did a tour of Japan, and then it was huge. Japan really caught on with the sport, but once we came to war, obviously, they're like, don't do that. Then it came back, and obviously, it's Japan's baseball has been huge forever and ever, and you can see players coming here all the time. So you could see that influence coming back, but you also, even like the Cabaret Club, that seems like an American, you know, that seems like something out of a gangster movie.
Yeah, it's even called Cabaret Drum. It doesn't even have a Japanese name. Yeah, there's not as much American, anti-Americanism that you would expect, even from just like casual conversation or angry remarks or something, graffiti, anything. There's really nothing, which is sort of amazing.
Yeah, and well, I think mainly because once again, this is still American occupied Japan. I don't think that movie would have gone through because there's still censorship at that time. But I don't think he was even trying to make it about Americans. It's just about, like you said, it could be set anywhere, like in Italy or anywhere. Just the war just happened. It hit us. We probably lost it, and we're still dealing with the effects of it.
The one thing I did notice that I thought was kind of American-esque was when he was playing the baseball game, the music in the background was kind of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star.
Yeah, there's, I have to look at the soundtrack, but there's like a few like American songs I know.
Yeah, Toreadora.
Yeah, from Carmen. Yeah. I was like, notice that. Like, there was another song. There was another song. I couldn't remember. I can't remember it right now, but I was playing during that scene when he's playing baseball. And like, once again, like, that's not a Japanese song. That's an American song.
Yeah. Right. So it's sort of a, but it's rousing and, you're thinking, wow, that's so, I don't know, weird. Twinkle, twinkle. Yeah, maybe for the kids? I don't know. It really stood out to me.
Yeah. After the show, I'll have to look it up what that song was. But yeah, you could still see it. Maybe it's like some commentary on maybe the American influence of Japan, but it's never like saying whether it's bad or good or not. It's just neutral. It's just there.
Yeah. It's just a fact.
And you can kind of see that influence. Probably my favorite Kurosawa film, High and Low, when they're chasing the bad guy through the clubs and they go to this. That movie came out in the early 60s, and they go to this place that's like something out of a, you know, like 50s kind of rock and roll movie. And he goes to this club. All the kids have like sunglasses and they're dancing around to like rock and roll music and jazz. There's even American sailors there on like leave or something. And that you can totally see the American influence in that scene.
You know what I also thought was very American, and I couldn't make sense of what it meant in the movie, to be honest, were the people on the street taking the Polaroids. Because usually when they do that, like if you're at Hershey Park and they take your picture on the, you know, screaming on the ride, it's so they can sell you the photograph.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
So they just randomly take their picture and then they hand them the pictures.
Like, that's not good business.
Yeah, I didn't get it at all. I didn't understand that scene at all.
What was the point of that? Because I was, like you said, I was like, okay, they're going to try to do that. They obviously are very short on cash, so they can't give it to them. I thought it was going to lead to this conflict where the kids fight them or something. Like, they're not giving me my money.
And yeah.
Nope, that scene just ended.
Yeah, it was just strange. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I did think putting the Polaroid in there was, that would have been the time. That would have been, like, really innovative and cool.
Mm-hmm. Once again, American influence,
but
too.
But not something you would give away. Mm-hmm. I remember back my first Polaroid camera. That film cost a fortune.
Oh, yeah. Like, you'd expect them to sell it.
Yeah, anyway, that scene sort of stood out to me as I didn't understand what was going on there. But there were other scenes I thought he shot beautifully, like when they're on the swings.
Yeah, which was something straight out of Akira. Uh-huh. Like, I was watching, it's like, oh, that seems like a lot like Akira.
Yeah, very effective, though, and looked good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you get that, even in the whole scene when they're at this, like, bombed-out shelter or remains of whatever, some house, and, like, they're sort of imagining themselves running this restaurant they have a dream of running.
The Hyacinth Cafe.
Yeah. And that was well done.
That was. Mm-hmm. Very bittersweet. You know, you could see hopeful, but yet afraid to hope.
Yeah.
In a way.
And which one brings into a couple of complaints I have with this movie. I'll do with the first one first, which is the biggest complaint I have with this film, is the fourth wall breaking at the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. First of all, that scene just drags a bit too long for me because they go to this amphitheater. They're imagining like he's this conductor of the symphony, but he's just like, you know, I don't imagine it. I don't something. And then the girlfriend breaks the fourth wall. And she looks at the camera and directs to the audience, we're this young couple. For young couples out there, we all suffer the same things. I want you to cheer and applaud for us so he can imagine this. And that completely took me out of the movie. And for a guy like Kurosawa, it's just, I know this was early in his career, but you know, he's smarter than that. And it seemed like really cheap pandering to the audience, and it was almost shocking. I'm like, why is he doing this? Seems so silly and dumb. And just for a guy like Kurosawa, this seems like this pandering to the audience is so beneath him.
I agree with you that I thought it went on too long. But I have read reviews from people who said that they were just sobbing by the time she got to that part, that it really worked for them. So I think it depends, because it did not work for the Japanese audience or the U.S. Nobody would clap. But in France, they clapped like mad. So
I don't know. Maybe it's just a cultural thing. But like when fourth wall breaking, you got to have a specific time. Sometimes you do it like for comedy, usually for comedy, right? This movie's not a comedy, and just having that scene, like I said, it seems desperate just like to get the people in the audience involved. Like, you need to clap, please.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I was just like, oh, like you don't need that scene in the movie, I don't think.
Although I did think the scene that followed that with the leaves, you know, rustling did remind me of American Beauty.
Oh, yeah. And there's no paper bag floating, though.
Nope, no paper bag. They didn't have plastic bags, that I doubt.
Mm-hmm. Which is, we keep bringing up American influence, but it all, you know, the corniness or the cheesiness of that scene, like especially when they're basically begging for the audience to applaud, to, you know, because we need applause because we're so down and out. It really almost feels like a Capricorn movie.
It does, actually. And you could really see Jimmy Stewart in that role, mm-hmm, without really having to try very hard.
Like, especially even the part in it, like you said, It's a Wonderful Life. Think when, you know, he thinks he's about to go to jail because they forgot the check. And he thinks everything's just falling down. He's blowing up at his family. And he's just miserable, walking the streets, about to, you know, commit suicide. And once again, it kind of feels like the character of Yuzo. He's just so down and out. Everything he's tried has just gone miserably wrong. And yeah, you can definitely see the Capra in this movie.
Someone says this is a stilted version of Mr. Smith and Mr. Deeds.
Yeah. Or even a bit of Meet John Doe. Because in that film, the whole thing was he was going to jump off a building. I forget exactly why, but he was like upset at, you know, humanity, mm-hmm, or yep, something, you know, and yes, like at that, you know, and even though there was, it kind of was a trick engineered by all these people, by the Barbara Stanwyck and her editor and everything, but at the end he feels, you know, due to things happening, he feels that dejection. He's about to jump off that building.
Well, that film and It's a Wonderful Life and Mr. Deeds, Mr. Smith, all of these movies from that time have a scene where somebody makes this speech.
Yeah.
So the fact that she breaks the fourth wall and implores the audience, almost like, look, how much more does this man have to suffer? Could you just throw the man a crumb? It's in keeping with that tradition of, at one point, somebody gives this big impassioned, mm-hmm, speech.
Yeah, I agree. But then none of those movies broke the fourth wall. I think
that's
the problem I have. It's not that she's not, if she, like, she just made a speech to him, like, you can do this, blah, 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 mm-hmm, blah, blah, I wouldn't be that big a deal for me. But the fact that they're directly addressing the audience, breaking that fourth wall, which still, to me, comes out of nowhere, and it seems like they're pleading for the audience, it just seems desperate. And like I said, for Kurosawa, you know, you should know better.
Well, while we're on the subject of this particular actress in this role, what did you think of her character?
It seems like to me it was sort of like an opposites attract. The fact that she's almost the exact opposite of everything Yuzo is. Like, even think of when they're in the zoo and they're looking at all the animals, she's like, oh, aren't they cute? Aren't they this? Aren't they that? And he's like, well, they're just this. Or he comes up with always like some sarcastic negative remark about them, and she's always positive. And so it seems.
He's complaining about it raining, and she's like, actually, it could be snowing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, always almost Pollyanna. Mm-hmm. But I felt so sorry for her. And I know that this is a dated movie, but he's so cruel to her.
Yeah.
You know, I know he's trying to drive her away, and that's the point And then he finally does, and then you see him pacing, and you realize he didn't mean to do that. But it's hard to then reconcile her coming back.
Yeah, which once again sort of connects it to Sunrise a bit, where you're just like, why would she come back? He's been terrible. In that movie, he tried to murder her.
Well, she had to come back for her purse.
Yeah. So, yeah, once again, it's all about, like, in that, just like in Sunrise, the relationship hits a certain low point, couldn't get any worse. Looks like they broke up. And then somehow, like in this movie, they rekindle their romance. They go to the coffee shop, have some pastries and some coffee. They imagine them running that cafe. And they go to the amphitheater and imagine they're having the orchestra. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of imagining.
Yeah.
But that's all they've got, I guess. They can't go anywhere. They only see each other on Sunday. It's very constrained. I almost wish we could have known what they were like before the war. So mm-hmm. we know, like, was he more fun before? Was he nicer before? Or was he always sort of morose and mopey?
Yeah, which is interesting because, like, why do they only meet on a Sunday? Is it a distance thing?
I think because they both work so much.
Oh, okay.
So that's their only time together.
Gotcha. Yeah, and there's also, like, a bit of comment, like you talked about with the cabaret club, it seems that there's a bit of commentary on, like, maybe class differences,
mm-hmm.
because that scene when he goes into the cabaret, everyone just looks at him, and there's no reason why they're looking at him. He's just regular, you know, rain jacket, you know, there's nothing strange about him, but it seems like this is like a hoity-toity upper class resort for rich people, and he's middle class or even
right.
lower.
He's not posh.
And when he tries to meet the owner, they take him downstairs where, like, the cooks are. And he's, like, talking to this guy who's, like, I guess a gangster. And it's implying that the owner of the restaurant's, like, in with gangsters. So they think he's, like, trying to pocket money out of him for some reason or blackmail him. So, you know, once again, they kind of just, even though there's nothing wrong with the guy, they look down on him because, you know, they're rich and he's not rich.
That's actually an interesting scene because he leaves his girlfriend outside while he goes in to see if he can speak to his former friend.
Yeah.
And then you see him being led, like, through this warren of, you know, offices, doors, and
dressing
prostitutes
rooms,
coming in
yeah.
and out. Yeah, and you're thinking, wow, this is really like a whole different world.
Yeah, it is interesting because, like you said, it's like a nightclub.
Yeah.
It seems like gangsters run it. And like I said, it seems like something from a crime film.
Yeah, and it also shows you like the current of lawlessness, and which also comes up later when they try to get some tickets, but you know, people are buying them and scalping them
right in front of them. That's
horrible. Yeah. Yeah.
And he gets beat up because he tries to stand up to him. Yeah. So we were talking a lot about this film, how I talked earlier, how this is a deep cut.
Mm-hmm.
So any other films that you can think of by great directors that it's good, it's solid, but it's been buried under the other work they did. I'll give you a couple. The Straight Story is mm-hmm. directed by David Lynch. Have you seen that?
Yes, I love that.
That's a great movie. Might be my favorite Lynch movie because it's his least strangest and mm-hmm. out there movie. But
yes.
he just tells a good story. It doesn't have all the, you know, weird crap he usually does. A Sergio Leone film called Duck, You Sucker. It's mm-hmm. a Western that was kind of buried under all the other films he's done. Here's a Brian De Palma film called The Phantom of the Paradise. It's way back in the 70s. It's this rock opera, which you don't really think of when you think of Brian De Palma. Those are a few I'm throwing out. I could even throw another deep cut of Kurosawa. The last ever film he did with Mifune was called Redbeard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very long movie, so it's over 3 hours, but really touching movie about, you know, a doctor sort of realizing that isn't just about status when you're a doctor, it's about helping people. But that's another good one. What examples do you have?
Well, I'm thinking about the other things in that box set, like No Regrets for Our Youth and The Idiot, which was based off of Dostoevsky. And I can't remember what the other names of the titles were. Depending on how much you have seen of Jimmy Stewart, you know, you can always go back to one of his old Westerns that nobody's seen.
Destry Rides Again,
yeah.
We talked about.
Because, you know, you might just think, oh, he's the guy from Vertigo and Rear Window and Mr. Smith. And then you don't even know that he did all those Westerns.
Yeah.
Or how about Humphrey Bogart before he was being, you know, portrayed as a leading man?
Yeah, like
when he was doing those gangsters.
Yeah, and, Angels with Dirty Faces, yeah. Petrified Forest. Yeah. Let me think of like actor, what would be like actor or actress.
What would be a deep cut Scorsese movie? Because I feel like all of his movies are pretty well known.
Maybe After Hours. Have you seen After Hours?
Okay, yeah.
That one. Maybe King of Comedy. That's not one a lot of people have seen. Even maybe Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. That's a good one.
And then lots of stuff Johnny Depp's been in has been sort of nobody's seen it because it's odd. Like, or even like Gilbert Grape.
Yeah, maybe. That was like Oscar nominated. But yeah.
At The Window.
Okay. I'm trying to think. Yeah, yeah. Any other examples of deep cuts you want to throw
out? I'm trying to think. Let me think. Name some directors.
Spielberg.
Spielberg. Okay. Well, AI.
Yeah, yeah, that's one. Maybe I'm not sure if this is a deep cut because it's one of his earliest hits, but Duel, the TV movie he did back in 71. That's a good one. Have you seen Empire of the Sun?
Yes.
Would you say that's a deep cut? Because I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I would, because not very many people even talk about that movie.
Okay, good. So we've been talking a lot about the Wonder event, and I know this is one of the movies that'll be featured. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, Wonder is the theme for the Horowitz Center for the season. So when we were picking our movies for International Film Week and Diversity Week, you know, I did a search for the word wonder, and I was thrilled to find a deep cut Akira Kurosawa. Because one thing that's always kind of great, if you can, when you're doing a festival is lots of people who come to the festivals are pretty sophisticated. They've mm-hmm. seen lots of things. So just to come up with something that was in the theater last year, you know, it might seem very timely and popular, but most people would rather you find some old gem that they missed.
Yeah. A deep cut, if you will.
And so that's why we selected the Kurosawa. So I'm glad to have it in there. Like it's not the Seventh Samurai, but it has its own merits, yeah. And I think people will like it.
Yeah, and once again, everyone who's a Kurosawa fan has probably seen Seven Samurai. This one you probably haven't seen.
You probably haven't seen.
I wonder, they could do a drinking game out of this episode, take a shot every time we say deep cut. But all right, then. Anything else that you want to bring up about Akira Kurosawa or deep cuts, take another drink, or One Wonderful Sunday or anything else?
Well, what did you make of the gangster guy? He seemed like he couldn't believe that the guy wasn't going to take up that voucher. Now, I wondered why he didn't also. I mean, why not at least get the food? I mean, wasn't the whole point to try to see if the friend could, you know, let him in or let him look around? Or why did he leave with nothing?
Was it a voucher? I thought it was like, you know, like he wrote him a check for like a certain amount of money.
Oh, I thought it was a voucher. I thought it was a homeless man that the gangster said, wow, you could eat really well on that.
I was assuming,
and
like,
since they were in the kitchen,
money.
I thought, you know, it was just way to get rid of him, which was here's a voucher for some food, eat and leave. And I'm just surprised he didn't take the food.
I'm thinking
and run.
He didn't like the way he was treated.
Yes, I know.
Maybe it's that he knows that something illegal is going on there. He knows that there are gangsters here, and maybe he figures he doesn't want to get his hands dirty.
You know, that's a good point, because I'm now thinking that a couple of scenes earlier, when he's talking about how hopeless everything is, he's talking about the black market.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, maybe I'll just, you know, get some work from the black market. She's like, no, you know, you don't want to do that. So yeah, that's probably what that scene meant. It was just one more instance of, you know, the depravity going on and having to make a decision to do the right thing.
All right. And last question I'll have is just tell about the class. Tell us about your classes.
This semester, I am doing Intro to Film, American Cinema, World Cinema, and Film and Philosophy.
All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing director Akira Kurosawa and his 1947 film, One Wonderful Sunday. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Tuesday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Tune into Dragon Digital Radio to hear the show a week before it's on Podbean. Press West, everyone, and thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me on.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, all you people, applaud. All you young lovers, applaud for your dreams.